Hello and welcome back to Party Material. In today's episode, I speak to a gentleman called Simon Dixon, who runs an agency called Dixon Baxi. And Dixon Baxi are sort of one of the larger agencies in the world now, in terms of their swing power, not their size. They work with numerous companies that do really large projects, from sort of AC Milan to ITV to Everton Football Club and loads of others. And we discuss Simon's early influences, his agency that he started when he was 19, where he designed rave flyers, and we discuss his practice and his need for sort of restless creativity. We touch on the idea of big agencies doing good work and if that's something that is important nowadays. And I think that's it. There's probably more, but I've just forgot. I should really write notes or something. I've got a list of... I'll shut up. I hope you enjoy. First of all, before we get going, can you give people that are listening that maybe don't know yourself a bit of a rundown as to who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's nice to chat to you, Brian. My name's Simon Dixon. I'm one of the co-founders of Dixon Baxi. We're a branding agency which is based in London and has been going just over 21 years now. And we work internationally creating strategies, design systems, and the execution of those design systems for companies all over the world, companies like AC Milan and Netflix and Sony, Samsung, big companies. And our job really is to help them connect to their audiences and their products and services. A lot of what we do is very digital first. And yeah, we're very lucky to have some really interesting work on.
Jumping back to where things sort of got started for yourself, is design and art something that you've had an interest in from sort of an early age?
Yeah, I was always into kind of drawing, and I used to draw comic books when I was quite young. So I used to self-publish comic books, and I got into illustration of things. And then as I moved into, I didn't do a university degree. I did a kind of vocational set of courses, and I did a foundation course first. And I like the idea of kind of expressing myself, but I'm quite pragmatic, I think. I suppose a problem solver by nature. So graphic design seemed a nice way of combining things like photography and printmaking and art, but in a commercial way. So it was vocational, which I liked. So I studied a kind of graphic design diploma, and that kind of brought all those kind of ideas together. But I've always liked, I suppose I'm a visual person, but also a thinker. So that combination of things that work for people, things that express themselves, but have things inside, ideas or systems that drive them.
Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe when you were doing those studies, you started a design agency when you were 19, where you design rave flyers for raves and things like that. And I've completely pinched this question from, I think it's the Design Boom podcast, but when Neville Brody was on there, he talked about this idea of having spaces where you're allowed to just create, and then they're quite important spaces for sort of young creatives to really get going. Would you echo those thoughts at all?
Yeah, I mean, I'd qualify it with, I like creating for people. So I think it's cool just to create, and I think it's nice to express yourself. But as I was saying before, I see myself as a commercial artist, so I'm creating for other people. And when I started my career, obviously the audience was quite small and very specific, because it was in the kind of music industry. But I like the idea that I was designing things that other people would connect to, other people would think was cool, other people would use. You know, if it's like a rave flyer or a 12-inch or a record cover for a cool band, they would want to look at that, hold it while listening to the music, and it becomes part of the experience. So I've always seen design as an expression of myself, but an expression for somebody else to create something that they would use, keep, or interact with. So I kind of agree with Neville, but I'd qualify it that way.
Do you think this the early work that you were doing there sort of set up the foundations for what you do now? Is there a link between the two, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, actually. I think there's a few things that... Because I started quite young, there's a self-motivation to starting your own agency. And to be honest with you, you know, I didn't have the experience and smarts and education even to really do that. But what I did have was this desire to create things that I really loved and I thought were important to me and I thought were important to make. So I think that self-determination is something that I've always held in my career. I've learned by doing, rather than talking about things or reading things or looking at YouTube hack videos. I'd rather just go out and make things and try things. So that served me quite well. There is a little bit of what you were talking about in Neville's perspective, which is if you get in the habit of making things, you progress faster. A lot of people procrastinate and they think about what they might do, what they might not do, or they do work they don't like. I was very focused on work that I thought had value to me and the people I was designing for. So I was very, very dedicated to just design work I wanted to do for the people I wanted to design for. And I compromised money, time, lots of different things in order to do that work. And that set me up on a path where I've had to compromise less and less as my career's developed in terms of the work I'd like to create and the control over that work. Now it's as part of a team, of course, rather than an individual. But yeah, I think the kind of self-determination and vision for the type of work and this idea that it's really healthy to make mistakes, try, learn, and make another mistake, learn and develop, I think that served me really well.
You mentioned YouTube there. You're not a fan of sort of YouTube video designers and things like that?
Not really, no.
No.
I don't need them, but of course they're helpful, and I'm being flippant just to be provocative, I suppose. But what happens is everybody can look at the videos, but unless you're making something that you really care about for somebody, whatever you're learning has no meaning. So I think there's a lot of conversation about technical aspects of our industry, the processes of our industry, the bullet points of our industry, how, why, what's of our industry, but not enough about the why. Like, why am I making the work I make? Why do I care about it? Why do I give a fuck in the first place? Because otherwise it's just technical education for the sake of it. And I think it's about expressing yourself to a deeper level and making things that are useful to people. So yes, of course, YouTube's amazing. And you know, I read hundreds of books, but it's the act of knowing why you're taking that knowledge and what you're doing with it, I think, is really important. Because otherwise what happens is everybody learns the same tricks. Everybody learns the same techniques, the same habits and behaviors, using the same software, looking at the same work all over the world instantly. And the work gets generic. It's not original and it's not specific for the people you're designing for. And that's why I'm very wary about my input. So I get a lot of input, but it's always based on what I do with that input and how I re-edit it to make something different and new, specific to the thing I'm making, rather than learning a technique and habit and going, hey, here it is. And then you turn around and another 10,000 people have made exactly the same thing.
Jumping forward a little bit, Dixon Baxi has recently turned 20. Congratulations. As you have grown over the years, has the philosophy that you've had going into projects and things like that changed at all?
The way we work has changed just because of, you know, cultural changes, technology changes and system changes. Obviously, the technologies and social media and the systems, the digitization of life has changed radically the way that we make our work. But the reasons for it are very similar, which is we like to push the work further, but we like to design for large audiences. So we like this idea of design for life, which is it's something that's fulfilling for you as a person, but it's also something that is meaningful to tens of thousands, millions, hundreds of millions, and in our case, sometimes almost billions of people interact with the systems we create. And that responsibility is really exciting because it's the democratization of design and its power to help people and, you know, get people to what they want and make the world a better place and a more beautiful and engaging place. And I like that. And I like designing for everybody. We've always had a high tolerance for risk as well. We see that there's a kind of risk of inaction, I suppose, where if you're not constantly learning and you're not pushing things forward and you're not restless to develop, I think there's a danger that you can atrophy as a creative. So we're constantly thinking about tomorrow and rebooting ourselves and relearning in order to feel fulfilled and like we're pushing forward. So those types of habits, I think, are important. And then going back to what we were saying a second ago, the self-determination of knowing the type of work you want to create, who you want to create it with, and the way you do. Because I think if you have an ethos and principles to how you look at work, you'll get further, and it'll take you further when self-doubt might take over or imposter syndrome or the industry tells you something different. If you believe in what you're doing, it gives you great strength and it gives you great purpose and sense of direction. So the way we work is really important to us, and how we work as opposed to the kind of technical process of designing.
You touched on designing for a better kind of future. Is that something that you take into the projects that you do? Are you looking to do things which kind of better the earth as a whole? Will you take on things that are kind of, you know, design for advocacy cat projects? Is that something you're looking to do more of or anything like that?
Yeah, it works on a lot of levels. Designing a better world isn't always about the environment. It's about connecting people to things they want. It's about communication. It's about the systems and the things that improve the way that we interact with each other, the world, and the vernacular of our lives. So I think what is a tendency when people talk about making the world a better place, it always goes straight to the environment. And of course, from our perspective, that should be table stakes. Companies should be sustainable, doing the right thing, not fucking people over, being diverse. That should be like a natural state of order. And then you do the thing you do for people. So a lot of that's hardwired into our projects. We try and have a good footprint. We try and do things that are value and meaningful to people. And we try and do things which are useful and helpful. And it really depends on the client, the application. And of course, we want to leave the world a better place than we found it. And that's what we'll do. But it's across lots of things. It's not just across one particular thing. It's a whole set of interconnected things that make the world a better place, I think.
If a company approaches you that were kind of, I don't want to say the Nazis, but, you know, they were horrible. Is it just a straight up no, fuck off?
Yeah, I mean, I might not say fuck off. I mean, it depends on how the meeting went. But we get contacted by people all the time that you might not necessarily personally have exactly the same worldview. And I think difference is really important. So having a different perspective and the idea that we can all come from different backgrounds is really important. So we're very careful to listen to people before we make a judgment. But there's clearly certain things we wouldn't do. Right-wing companies, oil companies. Many, many years ago in our, as we developed the business, we worked in gambling for a short period. And we were working on a project and suddenly realized this is wrong. This is not what we should be doing. The way that this works and who they prey on and the systems of that are not morally correct. So we just stepped away from that. Tobacco, we wouldn't do. We wouldn't do anything where it was toxic, highly pessimistic, like really negative. We wouldn't work with a client that was really bad, like a nasty person. We don't mind people being a bit angry if if they're a little bit stressed, but we look for a balance and we look for optimism and positivity, and we look for the ability to work together to make things better, and we listen to people because I think there's too much, there's a lack of celebration of difference of opinions, and it's got very rarefied, and everyone's in their little bubble. And those bubbles get smaller and smaller, and everybody's only thinking about their perspective on the world. And it's quite a dangerous thing. I think it's important to think about what other people think, because not everybody's the same. There's billions of us, and they're all very different. So we have a very specific perspective on what we think is right or wrong, but we're always very sensitive that we may still need to learn things and still need to be aware that we have blind spots or biases. So we're very cautious of that. But clearly, if the Nazis came to speak to us, we would say no, thank you. Well, we would say fuck.
Yeah. If it's the Nazis, I think you're out of time and fuck off there. You're obviously quite a massive agency at this point. Do you think that other big agencies do enough to kind of stick to the principles that are kind of just good human principles?
It's hard for me to make a solid judgment on that because I've never really worked anywhere that I haven't run. In my experience, the people I know who run agencies across the world, most of the people I interact with are very moral. They're very positive, they're very additive, they're very empathetic, they listen, they learn, and that sense of being curious about the world is really helpful. So I tend to be very optimistic about those things. I think the structure of how the industry has changed since I entered it, for example. So I entered the industry in 1990, so that's 32 years ago, and it's profoundly different. It was much more male, much more white. There was a lot of companies who were kind of very large and structured. There's a lot more space for independent thought, independent size agencies. There's much more room for different types of people. And I think there's lots of work to be done in that space. But I feel very optimistic that we're having a lot more debates about what good looks like than we were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I think that's really positive. We're an agency of 50 people. So from my perspective, it doesn't feel massive. It feels kind of right. And I think when you think about what you want to be as a creative entity, you have to balance the size that you are against the work you want to do versus how you look after the entity and carry yourself in a good way. So when I think about our agency, I think about the people first and then the work. Obviously, I want the work to be amazing, and that's based on our pride of the work. But looking after the people and making sure that they're fulfilling their careers and they're safe from the shit around them outside in the world, that's a much bigger driver for me. So I see that in lots of other agencies.
This is the next bit is kind of a segment that I have, a kind of a recurring thing. And if you don't have an answer straight away, I can just skip over it. We can leave it. But essentially, it's the idea of, if we were getting in a lift together or something like that, and I said to you while we're in the lift, give me something that I can go away and research, which you think has been the heartbeat of your own career, just sort of one thing that I could go away and look at. And it can be anything. It can be a song, a movie, a book, a person, piece of artwork, anything you really think of. Is there one thing that you could think you could give me that I could put into our Hall of Fame?
Well, that is a broad, that's a tricky one to answer. I haven't prepared for this one, so I'll have to do it off.
And that's what I was thinking, yeah.
But I suppose the thing that had the biggest difference for me when I was starting out was a guy called Wolfgang Weingart, who's a Swiss typographer designer. And he's from the Swiss school, but he looked at it differently. He kind of bastardized the rules, and he made work that I just found was very electric. And it was very visceral, but you could see the person that really thought underneath why they were making those choices. So there's a kind of typographic perspective. But when I started my career, the details of how design and the craft of design is made is really important to me. So I was trained in kind of classic design and things like that. So I think that's really important. If it was purely a visual thing, I would say 2001 by Kubrick. Which is a very, very obvious one to say, but every year that I look at it, and I've seen it in the cinema and you know, big screenings, I've seen stills of it, and I've been to the archive, every year that I look at it, it's just as good as it was the year I first saw it. And it's very hard to make design or art direction or craft that is that timeless. The movie isn't like necessarily, you wouldn't want to watch that every Saturday night. But the pure craft of how that film was made is mind-bogglingly good. And you can't get a crowbar in it. You can't think, how would I make that better? So that's difficult. If it was a person, it would be my business partner, Apoorva, because he's had by far the most profound effect on my life. So he and I have worked together for 28, 29 years, and we've grown up together and we've developed as creative people. And my life is profoundly better because of that relationship. Not just my creative life, but my life in general is better. But we've shared so much together in terms of traveling and building an agency and learning about creativity and getting better out of our jobs. So if it was a kind of, you know, a desert island type thing, he would be...
Well, if we're going through all of them, can you think of a book off the top of your head at all?
Oh, God, okay. A book. The last...
If you can't, it's fine. If you can't,
No. I read loads, so I'm just trying to think about a good one that was... I tell you the one I read recently... Well, it's not recent, it's a few years ago. But the one I read recently was Factfulness by, I think he's called Hans Rosling is the author. I might have got that slightly wrong. But it's about how the world has developed and, in a sense, our... bias of seeing things negatively, because that's how we're hardwired. And when you test people, they tend to see things more pessimistically than how the world is developing. And as I said, I'm quite an optimistic person, and the book isn't perfect. It's flawed in some areas, you know, in terms of how we look at the world and the sampling and things. But the positivity of how it says to you, look, take the metrics of how things have got better and let's build on that rather than saying everything's broken and fucked, I think is really helpful. Because if you take the energy of something that is underway and you use optimism to fuel you, you get further, I think, than just looking at the problem and kicking your heels.
You've touched on it a little bit, but obviously you touched on the idea of kind of relentlessly looking to better yourselves and better the environment. Do you ever suffer from sort of creative exhaustion or burnout or anything like that as a result?
I think it's an interesting question, burnout. I think it's down to control and the choices you make. Obviously, I get tired, I get frustrated. Even my kind of experience, you can get imposter syndrome or you can get frustrated. You know, it's part of the human condition. It's to be expected. So I think that I just embrace the fact that our lives and certainly creative work isn't linear. It's messy. If you progress expecting everything to work, you'll get hit in the face really quick. If you progress progress expecting everybody to agree with you and everything to work the way you imagine, you'll get slapped in the face really quickly. So I've kind of hardwired myself to get used to working at the tolerances I do and the speeds I do and the amount of work I do, because I like doing it. It fulfills me. And the energy I get from trying to improve myself and improve the studio and get better at what we do is really fulfilling. And I think I speak a lot to other people about this, and people ask my advice about it. And I tend to say the thing is, if you're locked into something you don't like doing and it's burning you out, you have to change it. So it's not about the number of hours you're doing necessarily. It's about what you're doing and why you're doing it and if you want to do it. Because I've got lots of friends who are artists and musicians and athletes, and they put huge number of hours in, but they think it's worth it. So I think if you feel that what you're doing is worth it and you can control it to a certain extent, it makes it easier to make those choices about when you work and when you don't work. Are you happy with the work? And that restlessness is about just being curious and improving, because if you keep fueling yourself with new ideas and you constantly learn, you're much less likely to burn out, because you're constantly developing and adapting and getting stronger mentally. But you're also just cleaning your mind out and putting new things in. I think a lot of burnout comes from doing the same thing regularly or doing it in an oppressive environment, or in an environment you don't want to be in. And again, you know, I would just take a holiday if I was burning out, to be honest. That's the simple answer. Sometimes you've got to say, no, I don't want to do it. I want to stop. It's okay to say that. Or sometimes it's okay to say, hey, look, I just feel a little bit like this problem is getting on top of me. And just talk to somebody else about it. Just talk about it. Talk to a friend. Talk to a colleague. Take time for yourself, I think, is really important. So I've built in little releases and valves. Like if I start to get really feel like I'm burning the engine a bit too much, I'll just go read. And I'll take some time to learn something new, slow down, do something else. And then when I come back to the problem, it often feels a bit easier.
The next question I wrote in, I don't know if it just sounds like I'm trying to start shit now, but... the thought that I had was when I'm looking around at the industry, a lot of what I'm looking at feels super homogenized and just kind of the same shit churned out a lot of the time. Would you agree with that at all? And if you just don't want to answer, because it sounds like you're just throwing something at someone, you know, we could just avoid that completely. But
no, fine.
I just thought if you had any thoughts on that.
What makes you think it's homogenized? What do you think the reason is?
It's just kind of everything's kind of, I think this was, I wrote these a little bit ago, but everything's just sort of gone like blobby and colourful, whether it was just a trend sort of thing, but it's just everywhere I looked, everything was sort of anamorphic illustrations, or, and then it went to sort of stretchy type shit, but then it'd go back to anamorphic illustrations or something like that. And then everything was just kind of the same, I felt.
Why do you think people do that?
Because they see one person doing it and then they just follow trend as the other person's done it, and it sells. It makes money, I assume.
That's about your two YouTube videos. That's why I'm that's why I'm wary of stuff like that. Because what happens, everybody can see everything instantly. So we all get the same stuff. And part of it is we're actually all living in the same culture at the same time. So if you went back to the beginning of my career, the 90s, the way we dressed, the colours that were around us, the fonts and stuff were different. But there was definitely a commonality to lots of parts of it, as there was in the 80s and there were in the 2000s. So some of it is general cultural development. But because of social media and the way our industry works now, that's far more accelerated. And then there's a lot of information about the latest trends, what works. And then that influences the people who commission design. So they'll look for something which they think will instantly make them feel solid and contemporary and like they're, you know, they're moving forward. which is why I say it's better to look behind the design rather than the style of it or a particular technique or a particular software, because all of that is should be in the service of making something distinct and different. And that's really hard. Getting to good is easy. It's really easy to get to good because there's loads of tricks and techniques. But getting to something original, different, is actually much harder. So you have to make more work, which feels shit, and then it feels generic. Then it starts to feel interesting. Then you've got to keep going, and then you've got to get to something that's really interesting. Then you get to something that's original. And a lot of people don't go all the way through that journey. They stop somewhere along the way. But the reality is there's a pyramid. And it's always been the case in all forms of creativity, which is there's a lot of crap at the bottom. In the middle, there's a lot of kind of okay work. As you get higher, it gets harder and harder. There's some good work. And then you get to the top bit and there's some really original, fresh thinking. And it always works like that. So we just see more of the middle than we used to do. So
someone that might listen to that might make the argument that nothing's original in a sense because everything has been done. And there's nothing that you can do, which anything, you know, everything can link back to something. Do you think that originality is a thing that still exists?
Yeah, of course. The way you pose the question, I think, is really good. I think it's a very good insight. You're right. It's original on the terms of how you enter the game. Because obviously, if it was science, the classic term is standing on the shoulders of giants. So if you're in physics, you can negate what Newton and Einstein and other people have done. You have to take that information. In creativity, it's the same. The way we've all developed culturally and the history of what we've all done will obviously influence you. I've just talked about, say, Stanley Kubrick and Wolfgang Weingart. But if you look at the work we do now, it doesn't look like either of those people. I've just used it as fuel. And it's how you remix those references, I think, is the key to it. Because of course, nothing is truly wholly original, but you can look at things with an original perspective and the idea that you want to create distinction with something that's different rather than something that necessarily fits in for the sake of it. So I think it's both yes and no to the question.
Over your years, I assume you will have looked at a lot of students' portfolios and interviewed a lot of students and graduates and things like that. Do you have anything that you look for in the person or in the work at all that you look for when you're interviewing them?
Yeah, it's another very good question. I have seen thousands and thousands of portfolios over the years and hired hundreds and hundreds of people. And I've always felt that, and certainly the more time goes on, it's all about the chemistry and relationship. And I think it's a mutual situation. I think when I'm interviewing somebody, I think it's important that they're interviewing me and us as well. I think it's a two-way thing. In fact, when we're looking for creatives now, I'll often interview people first. So I won't wait until the end of a sequence. I'll actually interview the person first. And what I tend to do is talk to them. I don't look at their portfolio. I certainly don't look at which university and things like that they went to. I talk to the person. I ask them a handful of questions about how they look at creativity, what's going on in the world and the way they express themselves. And I know very quickly how they think and whether or not I think there's an interesting kind of chemistry. And what I look for is a kind of chemistry, but difference in the people. I like the idea that we're all very different in terms of our mindsets. But there is a sense of seeing the creative world a certain way so that when we overlap, there's lots of difference to make the kind of melting pot rich. But there's a kind of common goal. So it's about true hunger and passion to make work you're proud of. It's about willingness to be curious and learn. It's understanding that in our case, because it's professional creativity, it's about designing for the audience at large and respecting them and being and caring and being empathetic about other people. It's being a good person, you know, just being a good person, someone you can spend time with. I often think when I'm interviewing somebody, I imagine myself flying to New York with them sat next to me on an aeroplane. And if I imagine that conversation would be really enjoyable for that flight, that's I've got halfway there with them.
That's a lovely way of putting it. That's a lovely way of thinking about it, I think, actually. And lastly, this is another big question, so I don't know if you can... I assume you will. If you've come in with this with nothing before, nothing, you haven't even looked at the questions beforehand, I think you've done a really fucking good job. This has been really good. It's like you're doing backflips and things to get to the... lastly... I ask this to everyone, but if you could go back to the start of your own career and give yourself one piece of advice, knowing what you know now, do you know what you'd tell yourself at all?
Yes. Again, another cracking question. It's not one single thing. It's a combination of things. The first thing would be to trust my gut. The second is the effort I put in is worth it to get to the level I wanted to get to. And the third thing, which is it took me longer to learn in my career, is put other people first, not you. That by far, that was the thing I learned later in my career. But those three things would be, I think, the things I would say to myself.
That's it. I have run out of questions. Hello. I hope you enjoyed. Yeah, if you want to find me online, I'm Pirated Material. Anyway, you want to find me, come find me. Chase me. I'll see you next time. I don't know how to end these. They're getting worse and worse as I do each one. Yeah, I shall see you next time. Bye.